Support for Sound Effect comes from WSECU. Local to Washington, WSECU is a credit union founded in public service. Today, WSECU serves more than 260,000 members. More information is available at wsecu.org. WSECU, serving Washington since 1957.
My name is Matt Kramer. I play in a band called Junior on the Prowl. We are a rock and roll cover band.
And I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and you're listening to Sound Effect from 88.5.
I play in a practice space in Seattle. We share it with another band, and our total cost for a 20 by 20 space in downtown Seattle is $750.
That's just one example of how the economy bleeds into art. When you have to pay $750 a month for a crummy little room where the lights don't always work, it makes the uphill climb of surviving as a musician even steeper. But it wasn't always this way. We sat down with Seattle music journalist and author Charles R. Cross, and he said 30 plus years ago, the economy intersected with rock and roll in a very different way.
I think many people that weren't around forget what the arts and cultural scene, in fact, just the plain economy in Seattle in general was like in the early 80s. There were many, many empty spaces that just were empty forever. So the capacity for a band member to rent a room for $100 in Belltown and live, or rent a rehearsal space for $75, was everywhere. You know, there was another big one on Capitol Hill, like in an area where, of course, there's apartments now and condos, but you would go up there and then in one room would be the President of the United States and the other room would be, you know, the Fastbacks, and in the room down the hall would be some other Sub Pop band. You know, there was huge gaps in the economy. There was Boeing and there was almost nothing else. There was no tech at that point. Microsoft doesn't come in until the late 80s. You know, tumbleweeds were rolling through Belltown. We are talking a decade or so after the famous billboard, "Will the last person leave in Seattle, please cut the lights out." That was the Boeing downturn. But in the 80s, culturally and musically, this was not a time of a massive amount of growth. Between 76 and grunge, early 90s, the only other band in Seattle that had been successful during that time was Kenny Gorelick, Kenny G. That's it. Nobody else probably made a living, very good living, in Seattle for 15 years.
Dark days indeed. No offense to Kenny G, but Cross says the hardscrabble times had kind of a surprising effect.
Things were so bad that the idea that you were going to be a band in Seattle and find a following, everybody gave up on that. And what I think changed was this artistic thing shifted, where people began to make the music they really wanted, as opposed to making music they thought would be commercial and would make them famous. So what happened is bands started to play, I think artistically, only for their friends, because only their friends went to their shows. But if you're playing just for your friends, you also are more likely to play what you really want, as opposed to try to play music that you think is going to make you popular and get you on the radio. So I think the bands that came out of Seattle in that era were in some bizarre way truer and purer than the bands that were coming out of LA and New York and other places. Because there was no possibility for them to be successful, they really gave you what they were on stage and in their records. It was the impact of those great records, which had a life long after the record release party, which really made Seattle. But it wasn't because we had a great club scene. My argument is always it's the exact opposite. It's because we had such a crappy club scene that people made great records. In the summer of 1994, five bands from Seattle released albums that debuted at number one in the Billboard charts. That's never happened in an American city. In some ways, though, I look back on that era and I go, this is such an unbelievable miracle that the timing of it all came together, where there's cheap rent, where there's a lot of young musicians, and where there's also talent adding together. That's a miracle that I don't know that we'll ever see again. And it's amazing that it actually happened. I think people take it for granted.
That's music journalist and author Charles R. Cross. And that sets the table for our theme this week. upside of the down. Stories of people finding something positive in an otherwise grim situation, right here on Sound Effect. Historian Paula Becker first encountered the Northwest author Betty McDonald when Becker was in grade school in Texas. She picked up at some point that McDonald had lived in Washington State, and that stuck with her because she remembered seeing Washington State stickers on the apples in her lunches. Becker's introduction to the author was the same as most people's, through her series of children's books, Mrs. Picklewiggle.
So the idea of the Mrs. Picklewiggle books is that there is this wise, kind of kind woman who is a widow, and she lives in this big old house, which actually is upside down. So the chandeliers you can sort of toast marshmallows on because they come out of the floor. She finds smoothing techniques to kind of get rid of bad childhood behavior. For example, a little girl who never wants to take a bath and her mother is just despairing. Mrs. Picklewiggle says, well, here's what you do. Just don't make her bathe. Let her get dirtier and dirtier and dirtier. And then one night when she's sleeping, once she has a fine crop of soil on her, some topsoil, you go in at night and you sprinkle radish seeds on her. And then when they sprout, she will definitely want to take a bath, and that is how it plays out.
So how did you come to learn that there was more to Betty McDonald than just the Picklewiggle books?
Well, so the first thing I did when I moved to Seattle, I mean, literally, absolutely, almost the very first thing was go and get my Seattle Public Library card, and started going at that time to the Northeast branch, and I made friends with the children's librarian there because I had kids, and one day I said to her, you know, Gail, this Betty McDonald, she wrote Mrs. Picklewiggle. Is she still alive? I had no idea. This was in the early 90s. And she said, oh, I don't think so. But, you know, of course you've read her other books. And I said, no, she has other books. I was so excited. I figured other Mrs. Picklewiggle books. And she said, oh, no, no. She wrote The Egg and I. Don't you know that book? And I thought, geez, that sounds kind of familiar, The Egg and I, but I hadn't read it. And so immediately she said, the librarian said, well, you can't live in the state and have not read The Egg and I.
And how would you describe the feel of a memoir like The Egg and I?
So The Egg and I, which was not marketed as a memoir at the time, is about Betty's experiences in the late 1920s when she married an insurance salesman who immediately decided that they should go and raise chickens and eggs on the Olympic Peninsula.
So you recognize that she had a real flair for writing, and writing in a very particular kind of voice. What did you connect with besides appreciating her sentences?
Well, you know, what really, really hit me with Betty McDonald was her sense of place. And Betty's second book that I read for adults was The Plague and I, which is about how she survived tuberculosis. And I was really interested in that first of all because she talks a lot about Seattle, and as I was learning my way around, I was reading Betty's books about Seattle, and I felt like I had a second set of eyes, like I was learning, you know, these things both in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and I was also learning them in the 90s, and it was very magical for me. So I realized that I could go to Seattle city directories, and I could go through and I could look up Betty's family name, the Bards, her maiden name, and I could see where they had lived. And then I realized that I could see where other people who she mentions in the story had lived. And so I went on this kind of treasure hunt of figuring out all of these houses. And I realized quite soon that the house that she had lived in during the Great Depression was just a couple of blocks from the house that my husband and I were renting in Ravenna at the time. And I was just like, whoa, Betty was my neighbor. And so I took to kind of hanging out in front of that house as often as I could. I kind of stalked the house.
Some professional loitering.
Mm-hmm. This became sad in subsequent years because the house was not maintained over the long term and eventually became a squat house. And so I had to kind of watch that decline over the course of 7 or 8 years.
And you paid it a visit right before it was demolished.
I did. I saw the sign go up that said that it was going to be demolished, and I was like, no. And I thought it would be valuable to save some actual physical artifacts from that house. And so I contacted the developer, and, you know, he said, okay, you're not going to like what's in there. You know, he wanted to first send me in with a police officer because he said it's in such bad shape. But the morning that they were getting ready to demolish it, he contacted me and said, if you can come right now, you can go through the house before we knock it down. So I started thinking to myself, I've got to do this fast, you know, and I was trying to experience it because it was valuable to me, hugely valuable and emotional. But I also was, I knew I couldn't be in there forever. I went to the back window and I saw the backhoe, the guy in the backhoe, he was knocking down the shed. And he had said to me, you know, when you're done, I'll knock down the house. Be sure you let me know when you leave. And so I walked through these rooms thinking, okay, this was Betty's mother, Sydney's room. And that means that this was where, when Betty found out she had tuberculosis, but she hadn't yet gone to the sanitarium, she was put to bed in her mother's bed. And then all the family came up and they were smoking cigarettes here. And then the nurse from the tuberculosis hospital showed up and was horrified that everybody was smoking. So I had like all of these Betty stories rolling through my head as I was making my way through and undoing with my screwdriver doorknobs and trying to get, you know, windows down. And I had as much as I could carry. And finally, at the very end, I went downstairs and I found the brick fireplace, which she's described so much how the family would gather around it. They had no money, but they could listen to the dance marathons on the radio. They would listen to football games, make a pot of chili that everybody who showed up would eat. And I just stood there looking at this fireplace that had been like the hearth to this family that I cared so much about. And I thought, I am the last person who's ever going to walk through this house. And it just was, I think, the most remarkable experience I ever expect to have as a historian. It was so personal.
So what did you begin to learn about her life based on those memoirs and a couple of others that she would write later, all within a really short period of time, actually? What did you learn about the kind of life she lived?
Well, I mean, you learn from reading the books themselves. And so what I learned is that while at the end of The Egg and I, Betty says that she and her husband are moving to a more modern chicken ranch with electricity and running water, and she's so relieved. In fact, in her real life, she actually left the marriage, which was abusive, and moved back to Seattle, and then spent all of the 1930s and the first couple of years of the 1940s trying to earn a living for herself, her daughters, Anne and Joan, her younger siblings, and her mother. In her books, she describes this in ways that are poignant, but also humorous. And the way that someone could not let what fate had brought them kind of pull them under, I found very, very interesting.
Yeah. So what were some of the areas where her private writings and her published writings diverged?
Well, certainly anything to do with her first husband, because they divorced and they had a very fraught kind of post-marriage life where he was, you know, put into jail for not paying child support, and it went on and on and on and on.
Yeah, so that relationship obviously came out very different in The Egg and I, which is really pretty funny, kind of whimsical, touching book.
Yes.
And what was it like for you? How did it change your relationship with her to learn all of this detail, and particularly all of the hardships she endured?
I was very moved at the thought of how hard she worked and what a momentous task she accomplished as a young, unmarried mother during the 1930s in particular. You know, how hard she worked, and yet she kept a sense of humor, and even including the bout with tuberculosis. I mean, gosh.
Yeah, say more about that. I mean, like, if you look at it, I mean, tuberculosis, divorce, domestic violence, yeah, poverty, I mean, all these very, very difficult setbacks that could easily have turned into a pretty mopey book.
Yeah.
But she managed to write in such a kind of jaunty, upbeat way. How do you think that she pulled that off?
Well, the bards have this saying don't be a saddo. Don't be a saddo. You know, if you're feeling bummed or down, you know, go take a walk or bake a pie or, you know, tell your kids a story. Do something. Don't mope. And so she had that as a really kind of basic underpinning.
Paula Becker is a staff historian at HistoryLink, and she's the author of Looking for Betty McDonald, The Egg, The Plague, Mrs. Piggle Wiggle, and I. Thank you so much, Paula.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer. This is Sound Effect, and today we're thinking about the upside of the down. A quick note that this next story deals with suicide. If you want to pass on it, you can tune back in about 10 minutes. In the Lower Queen Anne neighborhood of Seattle, on Tuesday nights, the doors of St. Paul's Episcopal Church open up, and inside is a unique art space. It's run specifically for people with mental illness and homelessness to have a place to create. Kay Eaton runs the mental health chaplaincy here, and she manages this program, which is called the Karen Korn Project. We'll hear why in a minute.
So we have just different kinds of creative projects. We have jewelry making, we have knitting, I'm a knitter, and we have a couple other knitters, sketchbooks, we have watercolors, we have coloring books.
The piano you hear comes courtesy of Brenda Neff, a musician and writer who's been intimate with mental illness and with the power of art to help people struggling with it.
When there's spaces in your life where you can't articulate because your mind is so in a quandary, the creative arts are absolutely essential and are the cornerstone for our spirituality, whatever it may be. And I think it's there that we can find our unity and our healing for our minds and our souls. I had become psychotic and was on the streets, and I had lost contact with my family. And one of the processes that had brought me back to reality was losing my most valuable thing in my life at that point that I carried with me was my flute. So I lost the flute, and then Kay Eaton and I had a ceremony letting go of the flute, which was such a powerful part of me, and using a new flute to bring in the new me. And so my goal in life is to use my words and my music in a very spiritual, healing way.
The Karen Korn Project is named after a young woman who fought her own battles. Her mother, Pat Swain, founded the project as a way to salvage some meaning from Karen's tragic story. We sat in a couple of armchairs off to the side of the art space, and she told me about her daughter.
You know, she was a very creative child. I remember once she went around the neighborhood with a questionnaire looking for friends. And I think she was about 5 years old at the time. They had to fill out the questionnaire. But that was Karen. And when she hit puberty, we started having a few problems. Karen, at that point in her life, was very melancholy. It was kind of like a dark shadow that, you know, followed her around. She was a ski racer, and they had a private ski academy in Girdwood, this little town, and she went there for her senior year of high school. So she really wasn't much into, you know, all of the cliques and the normal high school things, but she made great friends there, and she loved it. And then she went away to college in California, and I know she got into drinking. And I think it was her sophomore year, I got a call from one of the counselors that said that they were sending her home.
Karen took some time at home. She got sober and mentally healthier and managed to return to college in L.A. She finished her degree and began to get work in movies and TV, and then she moved closer to home, to Portland.
One night, I think it was actually Easter, we got a phone call at home from her boyfriend that he was worried about her and that she wasn't answering her phone. So I did what, you know, what you can do when you're living 3 hours away from someone. I called the police and asked them to do a wellness check on her, and they did. But that kind of ran a wedge between us because she didn't like the idea that I call the police. And about a year, maybe less than a year after she moved down to Portland, I got a letter from her. And it was just this horrible letter about, I don't want to ever see anybody again. It's just very hurtful, very striking out against all of us. And I didn't know what had triggered it. You know, it's heartbreaking. You think you know your child, and then something like that happens, and you can't figure out why. We didn't see each other for quite a while. And then one day she called and wanted me to come to Portland, but I had to come by myself, or she would kill whoever came with me. It was very erratic, and so we called her doctor, and the doctor said, call the police. And so I started down to Portland, and my husband called the police, and they went to her apartment, and she wouldn't let them in. So they finally got a key from the manager, and when they came into the apartment, she tried to jump off the balcony, and they caught her. And they ended up having to wrestle her to the floor and, you know, handcuff her, take her into the ambulance. So the summer of 2014, she was living in this little house in Portland. We were supporting her. And that summer, she decided to move out of the house. When she moved out of the house, she sort of moved out of our lives, too. And she got very aggressive and very threatening. She told us she was coming to Port Townsend and she was going to kill us. And we actually went and got a restraining order. And the thing was that there just didn't seem to be any help. She had been trying to get Social Security disability, and she kept getting turned down for that. So from that summer of 14 until October, we hadn't heard from her. And all I knew is she was living in her car. And then she contacted us in late October. And I got together with her, and, we cried and hugged and talked. And I think she was embarrassed by all the things that had happened and the things that she had said. I think she felt like it was hopeless, like she was never going to be able to get back to a place where she could support herself or pay off her debts or whatever, you know, and have a life. Thanksgiving was coming, and I asked her if I could come, and she said yes. That's all she said was yes. And when I got off the ferry, I called her, and there was no answer, which is unusual. But when I got to her place, her roommate was there, and we opened the door to Karen's room, and she was hanging. She had hung herself from the skylight, and she, there's no way to explain what that was like. People talk about having a broken heart. I honestly felt like my heart had been ripped out of me. And, there's not a day that goes by that I don't think about her. I think about all the things that she missed and things that, you know, she never got a chance to have a family of her own. Sometimes I see people out that look like her, and I follow them. There would be times I'd be in my car, and I would just scream as loud as I could scream. But a lot of times it's just this empty feeling. They had a memorial for her in Los Angeles, and they sent me the book from that. The things that people wrote in the book were like, she was such a big part of their life and how she helped them cope, and, you know, that she was so strong. And I think about that, and I think, you know, why? You know, why did you give up? And, I don't know. And then on top of everything else, see, she died in November, and I think it was January or February, Social Security paid her disability, which was almost like a slap in the face. Because I think had they come through, I think it would have stopped her. I think that would have been the hope that she felt like she needed, that she had would have had some income of her own. And then since she had no family, no heirs, the money went to me, and that's the money we used to start this project.
Pat Swain got together with Kay Eaton, the chaplain. They talked over different ways to honor Karen's memory, and they found themselves drawn back to the importance of creativity in Karen's life.
Karen was very artistic, and we knew we wanted to do something around the arts. Karen, because I think Karen used art to cope with some of her demons, and she had this place set up in her garage where she would do her art, and it just seemed like such a natural fit for her. I just think that this is something good that came out of something so terrible. And when I'm here, it just makes me feel very happy. And I kind of say to her, Karen, do you see what's going on? You know, how do you feel about this? And because I do think she would just love it. I think she would be here and she would be doing all kinds of things. And then, you know, when I leave, it's just good for my heart. It is.
Pat Swain lives in Port Townsend. The Karen Korn Project is open every Tuesday evening at St. Paul's Episcopal Church in Seattle. This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this week we're exploring the upside of the down. So let's talk real estate. It's a hot topic in the Northwest. A white-hot market like Seattle's creates winners and losers, depending on which side of the transaction you happen to be on. These days, you'd probably rather be a seller than a buyer. But back in 1985, when Merlin Rainwater and her husband bought their place, the roles were reversed. They were able to score a little bungalow on the east slope of Capitol Hill for just $50,000.
There was this wave of young, white, liberal activist folks who thought that it would be cool to live in a neighborhood where we had black neighbors. And of course, we also thought it would be really cool to have a cheap house.
It would take years before Merlin would come to see her move in a different light, as something driven by forces she wasn't even aware of that placed her and her neighbors in a much bigger drama of social change. Sitting on her front porch, Merlin says that vision of living in a kumbaya integrated neighborhood did not play out the way she'd hoped.
Over the years that I'd lived in the neighborhood, I gradually became aware that the black neighbors weren't really all that excited to have us white folks moving in. And I started to think about the question of displacement, and you know, people have come and gone over those years, but during all that time there has been only one black family that moved in.
One of the reasons this wave of idealistic young white people was able to score such affordable houses lies in Merlin's lap. They're detailed maps of Seattle's neighborhoods created by the federal government in the 1930s. These maps are a visual display of the discriminatory housing practice known as redlining.
So redlining refers to the line that outlined these red districts on the map and defined them as hazardous for investment.
And how did those red lines delineate neighborhoods by race?
Well, one of the really surprising things that I came across is the racial map of Seattle, which was created at the same time as the redlining map. And I have it here. And there's a northernmost section that's labeled Negroes. There's a sort of intermediate section labeled Jewish. there's a sort of horizontal east-west section that's Orientals, and then a southern area called Italians.
This is all in the central area.
This is all, and if you look at this map next to the red line map, the area that was colored red in the red line map pretty much outlines this area that of the undesirable racial categories on the racial map. For this little section, which is the heart of the Central District of Seattle, the only justification that the surveyors give for considering this hazardous is it states this is the Negro area of Seattle.
So what was the consequence then if an area was redlined? What did that mean?
Well, immediately what it meant was that banks were unwilling to issue mortgages for people to purchase property. So you would find that it was more expensive and more risky to purchase a home. People were more likely to lose the homes that they were able to buy.
The old maps that determined where people could buy a house inspired Merlin to tell people about this ugly history. Today, she gives bike tours along the old red line boundary. On the day we meet, she gives me a tour on foot.
This lot, the little cottage was demolished and this brand new house was constructed.
Is it recognizable compared with what it was like when you moved in?
Barely, yeah.
Redlining ended in phases in Seattle, with its final death in 1976. And as Merlin learned more through her research, she came to an uncomfortable realization. She had benefited from that discrimination. You see, back in the day, her house was in the red zone.
We had benefited from having an inexpensive house, partly because it was in a neighborhood that had been neglected and that has experienced disinvestment over generations. And then we benefited by the end of redlining because we were able to get a federally insured mortgage and very reasonable terms to purchase the house.
Did you have an emotional reaction to that revelation that you are wrapped up in this in ways you hadn't understood before?
Yeah. It was painful. I like to think of myself as the good guy, you know?
Even though decades have passed, redlining has left a lasting mark. We walk up to 19th Avenue East. On the west side, across the street, outside the old red line boundary, there are brand new townhomes, the kind that touch off bidding wars, and a restored pre-war brick apartment building with flower boxes. Inside the line, on the east side of 19th, we see several homes that are subsidized housing.
The red line side was slower to develop than the non-red line side, and I don't really quite know what to make of that other than it's something to observe that on this, the formerly red line side, there's still a number of older houses that look like maybe they're just waiting for the opportunity to be turned into something else. Okay, we're standing at the corner of 19th and Madison, and in 1928, this block across the street was owned by probably 20 or 30 different individual property owners. And they all got together and hired a lawyer and drew up a document, one of these things that we refer to as racially restrictive covenants.
In addition to redlining, there were these legal documents that prevented blacks, Asians, Italians, Jews, anyone considered undesirable, from moving into a house on a specific block. White homeowners would draft an agreement that might sound something like this.
The parties hereto signing hereby mutually covenant, promise, and agree with each with the others and for their respective heirs and assigns that no part of the lands owned by them, as described following their signatures to this instrument, shall ever be used or occupied by or sold, conveyed, leased, rented, or given to Negroes or any person or persons of the Negro blood. And it was significant to me to note that Mount Zion Baptist Church, the second black church to be established in Seattle and a very prominent, respected institution in the Black community, had just relocated to the lot diagonally across the street at 20th and Madison, 19th and Madison, in 1920. So it felt particularly insulting and harsh that it was directed at the prominent members of the Black community that had their place of worship directly across the street.
The documents Merlin has collected tell a story of how racial segregation didn't just happen. It was the result of deliberate policies and decisions. And she's dedicated to making sure that history reaches the people who need to hear it most.
White people, thanks to segregation, are able to live our lives without really engaging with African Americans and other people of color. That really shapes the whole way that we're able to deal with this legacy of racism. Because of segregation, white people often know nothing at all about this history. I was at the Douglas Truth Library, which houses the African American collection, is located in the middle of the Central District. And there at the library, there was a very interesting display of photos and documents about the open housing struggle in Seattle. And my first reaction was, you know, why is that here? That should be in Laurelhurst, you know, that should be in North Seattle, that should be in Wedgwood, in the parts of the city where white people live who don't know this history. The people who live here in the Central District, they know this history. They may not know the details, but they certainly have lived it and experienced it. People in North Seattle, they have lived that history as well, but we don't have to recognize it.
Merlin Rainwater is founder of Central District Red Line Tours in Seattle. To learn more about the tours and to see pictures of the old Red Line maps, you can go to our website, knkxsoundeffect.org. This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today our theme is Upside of the Down. There's a weekly meeting that happens at Seattle's Harborview Hospital, and everyone in the room has one thing in common. They're all missing a part of their body. Everyone there is an amputee. Some lost their limb years ago, and for some it's been just a few weeks.
I was hit by a drunk driver. She was 2.5 times drunk. Blackout drunk.
I tangled with the dump truck. He kept my arm. I am 2 inches above the elbow.
I lost my leg, my left leg, above the knee.
I was in a horrific boat accident on July 4th, 2015. Their boat launched over the top of our boat and their propeller severed my arm.
My pelvis was broken, my back was broken and detached from my spine.
The way I lost my leg is I was attacked by a shark. I was stand-up paddleboarding in Hawaii, and Tiger Shark just bumped me off my board and grabbed my leg.
It's easy to see the downside of these losses, but at the heart of the conversations that happen within the group is a determination not to let this physical challenge hold them back. The sessions are led by a retired nurse, a woman named Dee Malko.
I'll let you start over on this side, maybe.
I'm Michael Freeman from Tacoma. I've been an amputee now for 22 years, going on 23 this August. I was crushed by an 8-ton truck in a loading dock across the pelvis, and they took me out to Madigan, did emergency surgery, gave me a drug called heparin, which is supposed to thin the blood and reduce clotting. Turns out 1 in 100,000 people were lethally allergic to heparin. I turned out to be one of those lucky stiffs, so to speak.
Due to the complications caused by Michael's allergy, he ended up losing one of his legs. He spent 2 months recovering at Harborview.
And I met this miracle person here at Harborview. I cry every time I think about it. This person came in and handed me a bunch of literature and says, this is what your life's going to be like. This is what you need to be doing, exercises you need to be doing, what you need to be doing. And I looked at her and I says, what gives you the right to tell me what my life's going to be like? She looked at me and said, well, and she reached out and took her leg off and says, because I am one. That was D over here. I'm sorry.
The woman who surprised Michael by casually removing her leg is the group's leader, Dee Malko.
Let me tell you just a couple minutes here of who I am. I am Dee Malko, and I was in a boating accident also, Vicki. There was no drinking, but the fellow was going too fast for coming to pick me up after I'd fallen off the water skis. And so he went to turn to miss me, and the prop hit my leg, and it sliced it all the way to the hip. And I was grateful that they were able to save as much as you've got, David. It took some doing because I got an infection below the knee, and they didn't know if they'd be able to save it. It's a short level, but works good.
I'm Nick Barraby. I'm from Tacoma, Washington. I had my left leg amputated below the knee because of diabetes. I'm currently in a rehab home. I'm learning how to walk with a walker. The first year I gave up, I didn't get out of bed, lost a lot of weight, just basically wanted to die.
That is a normal feeling, very normal, because, boy, we had all our parts before, yeah. And to all of a sudden, bam, something's not there, maybe several.
It's like the fellow in there who said, I wanted to die. But then they start seeing there's some other people making it. This isn't what I had in mind for my life, but this is giving me a small vision of what could possibly happen. So they hear or see somebody. Even for myself, when I would walk in the room, I don't walk with a limp. And so they get a vision of looking normal again.
Troy West. I got in a fight with a log truck,
and
it drug over me, 34,000 pounds, and it was going to take me in, and I basically broke this heel, my left heel, to pull my leg basically off to save my life. My wife was a little scared, and she came to the hospital, and she goes, "You realize what happened?" I go, "I knew it was gone in the woods." I go, "The best thing I can tell you, pedicures were half off for me."
Yeah.
So, and I told my boss, if you want to hire me back, you can. If not, I'll go to work at IHOP.
If you take it too seriously, it's going to be a lot harder for you.
You got to be upwinded. So I was, and it hasn't stopped me since. So that's
true. Humor kind of lifts you out of the mud. It's there's humor in everything. These stories you heard today are beyond tragic. You will go so much farther, faster with humor.
Do you find yourself burdened by having to make able-bodied people comfortable around you?
Some days I get tired of it, to be truthful. But most of the time, I think it's a privilege. You want to make people understand you're not a creepy person, you're not weird, you're not a freak, you're a regular person who's had an unbelievable experience that you survived. And to kind of let them know to be comfortable about that. I think that came up in dating a lot. I was single at the time. And I know one guy told me, he says, "Don't bother you, I guess it shouldn't bother me."
Yesterday I had someone looking down at my legs, she goes, "Your skin is so smooth, what kind of lotion is it?" And I said, "I don't, it's not real."
That's Catherine Martin from Seattle. She's 55 and definitely a glass half full type person. She does not miss a chance to laugh at what might make other people fall apart. Catherine has type 2 diabetes, and a wound on her foot was slow to heal. It got infected, and doctors had to remove her left leg.
The first day after I got out of ICU, they said, "You're going to amputee support." And I had never been in a hospital before. I was really quite shell-shocked. I was still pumped up on the meds, and they wheeled me in. I was afraid. And there was somebody who was just really jazzed up, had a souped-up wheelchair, and just had a lot of life in him. And he kind of tapped me on my leg and said, "It's gonna be all right, girl. It's gonna be everything's gonna be good." I didn't know any of these people. I didn't know what was going on, and it just kind of centered it to that. No matter what's going on right now, and I get past this, it's gonna be good again.
Those connections that form in the support group have only gotten more important to Catherine. That's because she discovered that many of her friendships weren't as strong as she thought they were.
One of the biggest things I didn't realize is that a lot of people who'd known me my whole life said they didn't want to see me like this with the amputation. I had people who said that they would wait until I got a leg to see me. I have people who've known me my whole life, well, who've known me for 41 years and have not seen me since my amputation. And I was really stunned because I felt like I'm the same person morning, noon, and night. I just didn't realize that they loved me so little. That was huge for me. Because it never occurred to me to not be around somebody because they were missing a limb.
Back in the weekly meeting, the conversation covers a lot of topics unique to this group. They talk about how they deal with phantom pain, the sensation of feeling pain in a part of your body that's not there anymore. And for the people in the room who are missing legs, the discussion turns to the hazards of falling.
Once you're down, you really get over it. Because you think, oh, I can't fall. And if you do, you just let it go. And it's like you catch air, and then you just kind of bounce a little bit. And then you get up from there after your head stops rattling. But you just have to kind of let it go and not clinch up, because that's when you end up hurting yourself. But I've fallen in like the worst spots, like the crosswalk in front of Harborview, and you know, you're so over yourself, there's no more embarrassment.
I was going up some concrete stairs and the toe of my shoe got caught on a stair, and I went down so hard and landed directly on the edge of my stump, and the bone of my stump is right there, and it's just skin is the only thing that covers it. So when I hit, I broke the end off of it. That sucked.
Besides these very practical matters, the conversations can get deeply personal. Catherine Martin has been coming to this support group for 7 years, and as an amputee veteran, she says she feels called to be a role model, like the person she met in her first meeting, who let her know that everything was going to be okay.
I hope that when I talk to them, that they feel hopeful and capable, and I want them to kind of see the possibility that you can have or do anything with some adjustments that you want. And I don't say, I'm out here doing this so people can feel this way. I have no control over how people feel. I just hope that when I leave them, that they feel just a little bit uplifted, you know?
The Amputee Support Group will celebrate its 40th anniversary next year. Founder Dee Malko has written a book about her experiences here. You can find out more about it at our website, knkxsoundeffect.org. And that's it for our show this week. Sound Effect is produced by Kevin Kniestad, Jennifer Wing, and Posey Gruner. We got help this week from Janae Janik, Aaron Hennessy, and Kari Ploeg. Max Wasserman is our intern, and Matt Martinez is our executive producer. If you're hitting the road this summer, let us keep you company. You can find our podcast on Apple Podcasts, NPR One, or wherever you listen, including your smart speaker, and we really appreciate your feedback. Leave it for us on Facebook or email soundeffect@knkx.org. Come back for another round next week when our theme is Off the Job. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is KNKX.